On Tuesday, April 23rd at 6 p.m., the DSR Network and the New Republic will be co-hosting an evening featuring a conversation with Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg. The event will take place at the National Press Club. If you are a member and live or will be in the D.C. area and would like to attend, please email Riley Fessler at rmfessler@trgmedia.com. That's rmfessler@trgmedia.com. We have a few seats still available and would love to see you there.
Nine, 12, 10, 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of We're All Gonna Die Radio on the Deep State Radio Network. I'm John Wolfstall, your host for today. We're going to be diving in just a minute to talk with two really, really qualified experts on issues related to the conflict in the Middle East and Iran's attack against Israel with a variety of different missiles and drones and Israel's effective defense response. But one, I want to point out that unfortunately we're missing my co-host, Heather Williams, today. And two, apologize to our listeners. We have ended up with three men, which is not standard operating procedure here at We're All Gonna Die Radio or Deep State Radio. Unfortunately, with Heather not available, and we reached out to several other qualified women who understand this issue equally as well as Ann Kit and Tom, we simply could not make the timing work, but we strive to do better, and we'll continue to try to bring diversity and representation to our podcasts. With that, I want to say hello and welcome to Ankit Panda and Tom Carrico. Hello, gentlemen.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me.
We always like to tell you who you're going to be talked to by. Ankit Panda is the Stanton Senior Fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, a fine organization. And also the, we don't have rival podcasts. We have complementary podcasts. The host of Thinking the Unthinkable podcast, which is not nearly as well titled as We're All Gonna Die, and a good friend and a great contributor on these issues. And Tom Carrico, who directs the Missile Defense Project at the Center for Strategic International Studies. Tom and I are old colleagues and have talked about missile defense issues for many decades. And Tom holds a PhD from Claremont Graduate University. And both are really, really good geeks when it comes to understanding what Iran has in terms of their missile and drone capability, what Israel has in terms of its missile defense capabilities and how that has worked. And Ankit and Tom both also track, interestingly enough, missiles from other parts of the world, which are directly relevant to what Iran has and what Israel has been trying to deal with. So we're going to dive right in. And I'm going to start with you, Ankit, just from the Iran side. We'll talk a little bit later about the dynamic that's happening between Israel and Iran, but really, can you just give us your rundown on what Iran did, what they launched at Israel, and what that says about their capacity today?
Yeah, sure, John. I think that's a good place to start. So I think there obviously is a lot going on in the context of this crisis that I'm not going to get into just to keep our conversation scoped on this particular exchange of missiles and the ensuing missile defense engagements. And so following an Israeli attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus, a diplomatic facility, the Iranians felt compelled to take retaliatory action. This resulted in the most significant direct military action by the Islamic Republic of Iran against the state of Israel after decades of proxy confrontation between the two countries. Iran launched ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and drones from its own territory against Israel. So this meant that they had to actually fly through the airspace of neighboring countries. The Israelis, their partners, including the United States, Jordan, and a few other coalition partners, had a pretty good idea, pretty good strategic warning that some retaliatory action would come. And so readiness was fairly high. And of course, we watched this play out last weekend in pretty dramatic form. There were many reports initially on social media, for instance, that Iran's drones, which are pretty slow flying, I think the best way to think about drones is basically they're tiny aircraft without people on board, right? So they fly pretty slowly, that those drones had launched, that they were heading towards Israel. And as those drones were en route to Israel, many speculated correctly that initial wave of drones would be followed by ballistic missiles, which of course exit the Earth's atmosphere at those ranges and exhibit flight times on the order of minutes. And so that cumulatively then resulted in a massive number of inbound missiles and drones towards Israel. And remarkably, I think we have seen a very, very impressive exhibition of Israel's layered missile defense system working for precisely a scenario that Israeli planners had thought about for a long time, this kind of an attack from Iran, although with the assistance of coalition partners. So I'll stop there, and I'm sure I've left something out that you or Tom can fill in.
Yeah, well, let me just press you on a detail here. Do we know how many different types of systems and how many actual weapons that Iran launched?
So the number I have is over 300. I have seen a variety of estimates. It is still pretty early days, and there are I think we have a pretty good approximation of the approximate breakdown between the types. So of those 300 plus, most were small drones, including the Shahed drones, which have been used to great effect by Russia against Ukraine with Iranian manufacturing on Russian soil. About 30, give or take, were cruise missiles. So the smallest target set were cruise missiles. And then about 120 is what I've seen for ballistic missiles.
Great, thanks. Okay, so Iranian embassy in Damascus gets bombed. Iran says, we're going to respond. There was enough notice that President Biden actually returned from Delaware to the White House to coordinate the preparation and then response. Iran launches. And at that point, Tom, we're already sort of right of action point, right? I mean, as soon as we have some indication that Iran is going to do something, I imagine, but you're the expert, that all of the ballistic missile capabilities that Israel has, America has, and allies start to spring into action. So can you talk us through just generally how the Israeli response worked, but then also what went into making it work?
Yeah, no, I think that's good. Like Ankit, I've heard lots of different numbers for the several categories. I think I heard a few more cruise missiles than that. I think it was like 110 or so ballistics. But I think it's also important to emphasize that, you know, the line between quote unquote UAS or UAV and a cruise missile is sometimes a little blurry. And if you're on the receiving end of a Shahed, I like to call them flying lawnmowers, you know, it can kind of feel like a cruise missile. So I think kind of bear that in mind.
When the leaf blowers are going to my neighborhood, I feel like I'm under attack by somebody. So I assume it's the same sort of engine.
Well, let me come back to the engine sound on these things, actually. It's a very interesting detail. But in terms of the springing into action, you know, one of the first things that an American president reaches for in a crisis, as they like to say, is where are the carriers at? But one of the second things they tend to reach for, and we did reach for after October 7, was, hey, where are the Patriots at? And so we scooped up C-17s, which flew them to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, grabbed a bunch of Patriots and sent them to the Middle East. So the other thing is we have had a bunch of Aegis ships that we steamed into the Red Sea as rapidly as possible after October 7. And so that's why for the past number of months, you've seen Aegis ships schwacking and taking out quite a few cruise and ballistic and other things coming out of Yemen from the quote-unquote Houthis, mostly headed to Israel, perhaps also headed to shipping and that sort of thing. So you've got a mix of defenses there from the United States. You also, and this is important, have, this past weekend we saw quite a few just Tattoo aircraft, ourselves and the Brits, and also the Jordanians, that look, cruise missile defense from fighter aircraft is not exactly easy or optimal, as we emphasized in a cruise missile defense report we did a couple years ago. But nevertheless, it's possible. So you got all those things in addition to your allusion to the several layers of Israel's air and missile defense. Everybody knows the Iron Dome, but also David's Sling, which has American and European counterparts, sometimes called the Stunner. Poland is acquiring a version of that. And then above that, the Blast Frag Arrow 2, which is kind of akin to the THAAD system, Endo-Exo. And then finally, the Arrow, which is your purely exo atmospheric, which was first used last November at a missile fired in anger. And then, of course, used again this weekend. So all those things came into play. And it was a pretty remarkable, almost unbelievable percentage of things that were shot down. And I say that, you know, I think 9 ballistic missiles did get through to some air bases, according to reports. But the damage and the number of people that were killed, apparently only one person, is shockingly low. So we can get into kind of why that might have been. But it was quite a bit of stuff that was involved in doing this.
So I want to geek out for a second on this, and then I'm going to display I'll ask some broader questions that I think are buzzing around in the public sphere that people will want to know about. How do we track all this stuff, right? So Iran's a pretty big country. Israel's a pretty small country. We're obviously watching with all of our national technical means. We've got satellites, we've got drones, we've got ships. What is the complicating factor? Or how do you describe how we begin to see these systems take off? Is it before they launch and we're tracking launchers, or really waiting for takeoff and then we're able to track them? Like, how do you describe that to your uncle at Christmas?
Well, the short answer is it's a little bit of everything. Yes, there's some space stuff and there's probably some ground GMTI stuff, ground motion tracking. But a lot of this, especially in that part of the world where you've got a decent amount of ability to fly aircraft, we've got some pretty good aircraft for tracking, for looking down and tracking various aerial and many aerial threats. So I would imagine that probably played a big role there. The space stuff is, it's a question as to how much that is viable for actual quality track on cooler and slower moving targets. In some ways, the ballistic stuff is the easiest because it's hot and because it goes high. And so in addition to early warning from space infrared that would pick that up, we and the Israelis and other folks in the GCC world have lots of radars pointed in that general direction and have been pointed in that direction for years and years. So the ballistic side of it is harder, but I tell you, it's the low flying stuff that is that's harder to not really detect and to disaggregate from the noise and clutter, also to positively ID that is something that we want to shoot at, as opposed to a Cessna or a passenger jet or something like that. Those are in some respects harder, and the rules of engagement for them are harder as such.
Yeah, I made that analogy this week to a friend of mine who said, well, why can't we do this, in the United States off the seaboard? I was like, well, yeah, it's great if you're flying over big open swashes of desert when you've got however many small regional airports that are flying Cessnas and you're tasked with shooting down these other slow movers. It becomes a bit more complicated. And let me ask you, and then I'll be curious both your takes. So Israel seems to have done pretty well. And with all of these things, there's obviously an element, heavy element of preparation and skill and a good dose of luck. Iran seems to have done relatively poorly. Is this the best Iran can do, right? I mean, I guess they could launch more systems, but how do you rank what they just did in terms of how much they could do in the future?
Yeah, so, there's a healthy dose of uncertainty in announcing this question because, some of the smartest Iran watchers I know continue to debate exactly what level of damage the Iranians envisaged. I have to believe that it was higher than the damage they actually carried out. The numbers I've seen, again, match what Tom said, about 9 ballistic missiles were able to penetrate and strike a couple air bases. So the Iranians did ultimately deliver kinetic effects on Israeli soil from their own soil. We can debate whether that's a proportionate response, the level of damage they inflicted on Israel, whether that's proportionate for the damage that Israel inflicted on the Iranian embassy in the first place. I think you could make a case that that's roughly proportionate. But of course, the intensity of this strike raises questions about what level of damage did the Iranians intend, right? So that answering that question would require us to know what level of efficacy did the Iranians assign to Israel's layered missile defense system, which is very well known to be effective in general. The Iranians have a lot of good data on this. They've observed, for instance, the 2021 engagements between Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, albeit with a very different class of largely unguided rockets, largely uncomparable to what the Iranians launched. So if the Iranians, let's say, assumed that Israel's missile defense system would be 99% effective and they launched the number of projectiles that they did, baking that assumption in, well then, okay, we can conclude that the level of damage we observe lines up with Iranian intentions. But I think there might be more to this story. I do think there was some attempt by Iran to mitigate the potential consequences of such an attack, because this is incredibly escalatory, right? I disagree pretty strongly with some of the analysts that have described this Iranian strike as performative or broadly designed to symbolically demonstrate the Islamic Republic's capability to retaliate. I don't think that's what's going on at all. And so those questions, I think, remain quite pertinent. The other thing I will bring up, though, is Hajizadeh, who's the direct, who's the head of Iran's aerospace forces. He oversaw these attacks. He just delivered remarks within the last 24 hours, indicating that the Iranians deliberately used some of their older, kind of ricketier missiles, that they didn't use some of the newer stuff that could be a little bit more effective. So in the attack, we see, you know, longer range missiles like the Imad and the Shahab 3 and the Qadr 110. Listeners don't need to worry about what precisely those are. But broadly, these aren't the newer, more sophisticated Iranian systems, which would include systems like the Khorramshahr, the Qasem, the Sigil, and newer hypersonic systems, which they could have employed to potentially stress Israeli air defenses more if they wanted to.
I sort of view the argument that Iran really didn't mean to do too much damage as basically people saying, yeah, they're like the guy in high school who's saying, hold me back, right? When they just fired 300 projectiles at Israel with high explosives on them. And, you know, you throw a punch, you expect it to land. You don't hope for it to get blocked. So I'm very skeptical of that. But I think the argument that they didn't use some of their more advanced stuff suggests Iran at the very least wants other steps on the ladder of escalation should they feel like they need to go higher or they want more capabilities. Tom, I want to ask you a similar question on the flip side. Is this the best Israel can do, right? I mean, are Israeli capabilities being stretched by this, or was it sort of a good walk in the park for them?
Let me first address the Iranian thing a little bit, which is I am not in the habit of believing a word that comes out of the mouth of Iranian military. It's also, you know, interesting that he's saying this after the fact when he seems to have, performed so poorly. I am at the same time, and likewise, I agree that I do not buy the theory that this was performative, that they were just doing it to kind of have an expression. And I would say by way of comparison, after the killing of Soleimani, who had it coming, Iran sent 27 ballistic missiles to al-Assad, to U.S. bases in Iraq. This is an order of magnitude more than that. And so for the folks who are saying, oh, they didn't think anything would get through, I mean, you don't send 330 plus of anything, as you said, and not at least expect that some bad things will happen in terms of not using their better stuff. You know, they might have wanted to save that for another day because, you know, think about the secondary and tertiary effects if their better stuff was either tracked and seen and also didn't perform well. That would put them in a even more of a pickle. So in terms of Israel, you know, 99% isn't good enough for you. I mean, but actually, on a serious note, I've been cautioning folks about not getting too triumphal about this. And being careful. Now, look, I actually think for deterrence purposes, it makes sense for the Israelis to do something as opposed to just, quote unquote, take the win. And I say that for longer term deterrence purposes and give some examples as to why. But in terms of the defenses, this came at a heavy cost. Those VLS tubes on those Aegis ships, we employed an SM-6 for the first time some weeks ago. We used an SM-3 for the first time on this thing. It's not just the cost, and I'm happy to debate the cost exchange ratio thing, which is so often used and abused and with clickbaity headlines. But it's not the cost exchange ratio as much as it is the capacity, that the exhaustion of capacity of whether it be Aegis, SMs, or ESSMs, or Patriots, ours, or the Israelis, or anybody else's. Those things are finite resources, and we've been expending them as well as, let's just say, Tomahawks since October 7, far faster than we're replacing them. And that's a problem. And so I think about this as much about capacity of us and the Israelis. It's not just about going and building thousands more Iron Domes. Those are easier to build in Camden or wherever than it is to do the higher end stuff. So the attrition, I look at this big 330 plus objects, projectiles, as something of an interceptor sink. And so don't take your air and missile defense capabilities or capacity for granted.
So we're going to segue in a minute, but I'm so old that I can't let this drop, because I was around when Paul Nitze put out his criteria for effective missile defense and did talk about things being cost effective at the margin, right? Is it cost effective for you to intercept these missiles? Meaning, is your interceptor is a reasonable price range compared to what it costs people to build more offense? Now, he didn't bring into it two points, one you just raised and one that has to be factored in. One is production capacity, right? Because it is how fast can they build offense? How fast can we build defense? Defense is more sophisticated. And as you just said, we're stretched. The other thing is you have to calculate in the damage avoidance, right? How much are you protecting through these missile defenses? You have to factor that value in the cost. Right. And so I don't get into I don't care who the bad guy is. It's worth intercepting their missiles when they're coming at you or your allies. Like, we want that to happen. We don't want to throw money at systems that don't work, but we do want to have very effective systems that do work. But there is this challenge where if Iran is throwing old stuff and we're firing everything from air-to-air missiles from F-15s or F-35s, or as you said, sending up our most sophisticated SM-3 surface ship-to-air interceptor, which people believe will form the core of future more advanced missile defense capabilities, which can be quite expensive. That is an issue we have to worry about in terms of both cost and capacity.
Yeah, I would say that the calculation, it's not just the difference in cost and value. It's the fact that not enough factors are going into the calculation of cost. And what do I mean by that? Look, it takes a lot of funds to steam those Aegis destroyers to the Red Sea and park them there and operate them there, even if, let's just say for the sake of argument, they were just shooting stuff down with bullets, cheap bullets. You have to, when you do the calculations, you need to think about the life cycle and the, not really the life cycle, excuse me, but the kill chain. And so the cost of the platforms and the operation, that goes into it. And so when you start doing that, you realize, oh, geez, the relative cost of the munition is a rounding error. And it is expensive for the United States of America to have our broad deterrence and defense goals globally. That's the real cost ratio. But as a country, we've said we have these expectations. And so I think when you begin to calculate cost differently, it puts you in a different place.
Yeah, and I guess I would call that both the operational costs, and then there's an opportunity cost as well, right? So right now we have one crisis. Okay, we have actually one big crisis and a whole bunch of little crises, but this is one of the things that strategic planners have to worry about, which is, if we have multiple challenges at the same time. So, Ankit, I want to come back to you for a second, and let's go broader, because, I think Tom raised an important point, which is, how do you deter the Iranians from doing something like this again? This is an escalation, right? Israel attacked an Iranian embassy, and technically that's extraterritorial, though I found out legally it's not really Iranian territory. It's just treated like it's Iranian territory. It's still Syrian space. But what Iran did is different, right? They attacked Israel proper. And so the argument right now, and we know these people, right? President Biden is telling Bibi, look, take the win. Don't make this worse. Let's try to move and deal with some of these larger issues we've got. And Bibi obviously struggling with both the deterrent argument and the political argument and then his own corruption. So, I mean, do you buy the argument that Israel has to do something in response in order to maintain some credible deterrent towards Iran? Or do you think Iran sort of understands what's happened here and Israel can skip this one?
So, look, I mean, I think normatively, you know, what I would recommend in this case is, look, for de-escalation to happen, you need both sides to be able to come up with a narrative that they have accomplished their objectives. We've seen that in previous crises, from South Asia to the Korean Peninsula to Europe. You know, I can name many examples. And in this case, we already have a version of that, right? For the Israelis, there is, of course, the remarkably good performance of the integrated air and missile defense system, the 99% success rate that they're claiming. That helps them kind of, in a way, mitigate the incentives for escalation. But of course, now they've publicly committed to escalate. And as you highlight, Netanyahu's got not just deterrence considerations on his mind, but his own political future to consider as well. And similarly for the Iranians, everything that I see on the Iranian side, what they're telling their own people domestically, what they're telling the more hardline components of their own system suggests that the Iranians are content to terminate here. And then look, I mean, we have to be, you know, honest about the deterrence implications of this too, because deterrence does not necessarily solely rest on the threat of punishment, although I think that is what the Israelis appear to be thinking through most closely. You also have deterrence by denial, and this is arguably one of the most successful demonstrations by a defender that deterrence by denial can have real strategic benefits. So the Israelis have shown the Iranians that a large mass missile and drone barrage is unlikely to accomplish the military objectives at costs acceptable to the Iranian side. The Iranians could overcome this by committing additional missiles. And as Tom highlighted, these are finite resources for the Israelis. We don't know, for instance, how many Arrow 2 and Arrow 3 reloads the Israelis have remaining after the events of this weekend. But in any case, I think the way to sort of think about the deterrence implications of this is, on the one hand, the Israelis show all of their adversaries that they will have the ability to deny military benefits. They arguably showed a version of that in 2021 with the Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad massed rocket fire as well. And so the compulsion to retaliate, I think, will largely be born of the allure of the logic of deterrence by punishment, which has to do with reputational factors as well. And this is, I think, the point that Tom might have been making about longer-term considerations about credibility and resolve. Israel, I think, has thought about deterrence in these terms practically. I think the Israeli policy and defense community does see value in the state of Israel projecting and maintaining this reputation for exacting costs in the form of punishment. So my normative observation and my analytic observation differ a little bit, because I do think the Israelis will continue to retaliate. And I think that's where we have to then account for the possibility of further escalation.
And we shouldn't let the podcast happen without also discussing the fact that Israel is demonstrating that retaliatory instinct in Gaza, right? I mean, this, I won't put words in your mouth, but in addition to going after Hamas, there's also an arguably a broad collective punishment approach here, which is, if you come at Israel and you hurt us, we will do damage to everybody you know and everybody you're related to so that you never think about doing it again. I don't think that that's what's at work in Iran, because they're obviously dealing with the nation state, and Israel and Iran have a lot of relationships. But I think we have to think about all that in the broader context. Tom, you wanted to jump in here.
I think I'm close to that position. I think it's important. It is sometimes peculiar that Iran's spasmodic reactions are a necessary response, but anything Israel does is quote unquote escalation. I think the reason I lean on the side of some kind of kinetic thing as opposed to just playing catch and taking it, look, you may not expect this, but as an air and missile defense aficionado, relying upon that alone is a terrible idea. You can't sit and play catch. The very fact that we're having this conversation is a luxury that has been afforded by the remarkable effectiveness of Israel and the U.S. and other air and missile defenses. But that doesn't mean either from a overall deterrence, or just frankly, I prefer the words retorsion or reprisal. You know, so many times when the United States and other folks have, quote unquote, took it, it just emboldens Iran. And my favorite episode of this is when the Trump administration failed to reply, respond, and canceled at the 11th hour the response to the shoot down of an American Global Hawk. What did that do? It emboldened Iran and lots more attacks on U.S. forces in the region, which then led up to the target of Soleimani, which then led to the al-Assad. People often forget that sequence and how we got to the Soleimani when everybody says, oh, you just go after Soleimani to be tough. No. That got there because it was originally weakness that was provocative. And I'll say the same thing about the Biden administration, taking it for way too long, a plain catch from the Red Sea before going in and doing attack ops, which were also far too surgical in Yemen just a couple of months ago.
I appreciate your bipartisan criticism of everybody under the sun. I'm reminded of my mother's expression when my brother and I would fight, which is like, look, I don't care who started it. I'm finishing it, right? And, you know, these arguments go on before we were even born. We're going to take a short break, and we're fortunately going to have to say goodbye to our general listeners. This is the part of the program where we point out that if you want to get access to all of not only We're All Gonna Die radio content, but all of the back-end content from Deep State Radio, you can go to deepstateradio.com. You can pay $7 a month. It's a bargain. It's way cheaper than Iron Dome, Arrow 2, THAAD, Patriot missile batteries, and you'll be much better armed to deal with the conversations around either your Passover or Mother's Day table. But for those listeners who will be departing us, thank you for listening. And for those loyal members, please bear with us.